Welcome to Bergenomics, demystifying economics with Ross McDowell.
Welcome to Bergenomics, the podcast that demystifies economics. I'm Ross McDowell. It sounds like a dream. Your mortgage payments have been shrinking, your house keeps increasing in value, and your boss gives you a raise. You're probably feeling so good, hamburgers for the family are no longer a treat but a regular indulgence. I'm describing some of the effects of quantitative easing, a phrase we're hearing a lot of in the media. Many believe our economy has become addicted to the effects of quantitative easing, and like all addictions, there might be some painful withdrawal effects if it stopped. Jobs disappearing, mortgage payments going up, to name just a few. To demystify quantitative easing, my expert today is the guru of all economists at the ANZ Bank, the bank's head of economics himself, Mr. David Plank. David runs a team of Australia's brightest economists who advise on $1 trillion of ANZ assets. If there's anyone that can demystify quantitative easing and then apply its effects to a hamburger, it's David. Our podcast was recorded during one of the many COVID lockdowns, so if the sound quality is a bit echoey, it's because my guest isn't talking from one of ANZ's bank vaults, but his dining room at home. David, welcome to Bergenomics.
Thank you, Ross, for that very kind introduction.
Now, David, if I've ever heard a phrase that explains absolutely zero about what it means, it's the term quantitative easing. Most people hear it and switch off because they have no idea what it means. Where does the term come from and what's it actually meant to describe?
So the term itself was coined by a German academic in the 90s, and at the time he was looking at Japan and arguing what could they do next to get out of the deflation they were in, or periods of very low inflation, and they'd already cut interest rates to zero essentially. And so he thought one thing they could do was he coined the term quantitative easing, and by that what he meant was the central bank going out and buying a quantity of government bonds or other assets. And the idea was that in so doing, they would put more liquidity or cash money into the system, and that would have, you know, a positive impact on economic growth over time and therefore flow through eventually to inflation.
Okay, so
it refers to the purchases of other assets by the central banks.
Can we say the Australian economy became weaker and the Reserve Bank worried people might start losing their jobs? Predictably, the economic medicine for this was to lower interest rates, which the RBA did until they became almost zero. So this put more money in people's pockets, which normally would have revved up the economy, but the economy never revved up. The only action left the Reserve Bank was to create billions of dollars of money, which never previously existed, push it into the economy to create spending, basically to keep everybody employed.
Yes. Now, some central banks have gone negative, but central banks are looking around for other tools, and this has been suggested as one other tool, where they can have another influence on the economy by directly purchasing other assets.
Okay, so central banks, for those people that aren't able to differentiate what a central bank is, a central bank is the bank of the government. It's not a bank that you and I can put our money per se. They're not in the shopping centre. It's the bank that sets interest rates, and it's meant to be independent upon the government. Have I got that right?
Yeah, the independence is a relatively new thing. I mean, central banks like the Reserve Bank of Australia, Reserve Bank of New Zealand, like you say, are government entities, and really independence of their ability to make a decision really only came about in the late 80s, on the 80s into the early 90s, it became more and more popular to do that. Before the early 90s, in Australia's case, you know, the treasurer had a big say in what interest rates might be. And in setting interest rates, the only interest rate that they can control directly is the cash rate. So longer-term interest rates are driven by the market, but of course what the RBA or the central bank does for the cash rate, the overnight rate, has some influence on longer-term rates as well.
Okay, so people's mortgages, that's really determined by what you're calling the cash rate.
But the RBA's cash rate is the most important for mortgage rates in a country like Australia, where most mortgages are floating rates.
Okay, so you're describing a situation where our central bank sets this cash rate, which influences a whole lot of things, but mortgages being the most important one for the mums and dads of Australia.
Yes.
And and that cash rate got so low because of circumstances, maybe the global financial crisis, that you couldn't keep on lowering it. It was nowhere to go other than zero or negative territory. So if the economy got into trouble or there was another GFC, there was no lever, if you like, left then to be able to boost economic activity. So they've come up with this concept called quantitative easing. Is that basically where we're at?
That's it precisely. So, yes, the cash rate, they ran out of room. You can take the interest rates negative. Some countries have done that. The Reserve Bank of Australia has said that it doesn't think it's a good idea. There are pros and cons about doing that. But even if you thought you could take interest rates negative, there is a limit to how negative you can take them, because then people will take the money out of banks and just have cash. And so quantitative easing is another one of the tools that central banks have looked for as they've run out of room to use their traditional instrument of the cash rate. Yes.
So if they were to go to a negative cash rate, which you've said has happened in some countries, does that mean that you would look at your bank statement every month, and if you'd put in $1,000 at the end of the month because there's negative interest rates, the bank would actually give you a balance less than $1,000?
Yes. I mean, in some countries, there are negative interest rates. So if you leave exactly that, if you leave $1,000 at the bank, at the end of the month, you get 990 something back. So okay. Yes, you get less back than you gave the bank.
So you'd be basically leaving your $1,000 in the account for the reason that it would be safe. In other words, the economy is that tense, there could be bigger problems around the corner, you'd be happy to pay the bank some of your money just to ensure a lot more of it didn't disappear.
Yeah, that's why people would put up with negative rates. Of course, what the central bank's hoping you do as interest rates fall to low levels or go negative is that you will take that money and buy something with it.
Okay.
And whether that's a car, or you spend it on consumer goods, or whether you go out and buy other assets,
yep.
What they're trying to do by lowering interest rates, whether they're still positive or actually go negative,
yep.
The whole purpose of that is to encourage you to spend more on something.
Okay.
And if you spend more on consumer goods, obviously you drive economic growth. If you spend more, if you buy another asset, you buy a house or you buy equities and you push up the prices of that,
yep.
That creates what we call a wealth effect, which makes people feel wealthier and then leads to more spending again.
Okay. We'll get to that at the end before we get to the famous hamburger test, David. So you've said to me that it's basically the Reserve Bank of Australia, it's a bond buying program. What's a bond?
So a bond is a promise by the person that issued the bond. It's how governments and how lots of corporations and banks and so on borrow. So what, but there's a market for bonds. And so yep. The market will say, okay, we'll pay the government X amount of dollars for that bond and that string of interest rates. And then the government gets the cash, which it can then spend on things. And then it has this commitment to pay interest and then the principal, the bond value, back to the person it borrowed the money from at the end of the life of the bond.
So there's a certain date that the money has to be repaid back.
Yes. Yes, for most bonds. There are bonds, not very many, but there are bonds that are called perpetual bonds where there's no requirement to pay them back.
Yep.
But then you're just paying out an interest rate forever.
Okay.
But yes, the government has nearly $1 trillion in debt at the moment. And that debt is in the form of bonds that it's issued over the last few years. And those bonds can be 6 month, 1 year, 2 year, 5 year. There's 40-year bonds out there. So the government owns bonds that don't mature for 30 or 40 years.
Why does the Australian government need the Reserve Bank to act as a middleman buying bonds with money they just created on a computer keyboard? Why doesn't the ABA just create the same amount of money and hand it to the government who spend it, creating the same increase in activity? I mean, the whole RBA weekly creation of $4 billion of bond buying seems a pretty complicated process.
That's where the modern monetary theory people come in, MMT, and they say, well, why not cut out the middlemen and just get the RBA to give the money to the government? There's the main reason we don't do that is around the credibility of monetary policy. If you had the central bank directly funding the government with kind of no step in between, which is that, and the critical step in between is that the RBA makes the decision about whether to do QE or not, not the government. The concern would be that if you got rid of that step and the government just funded itself, you end up with all the stories around hyperinflation and so on. And I think how realistic that concern is depends on the politics. The reason that central banks were given independence back in the 80s and 90s progressively was because the politicians decided that they couldn't be trusted to run monetary policy, and that had real costs, and so it was better to make central banks independent. So I think going back the other way is a big step. But the quantitative easing is that by the RBA announcing, and that's the announcement effect as much as the actual doing that matters. By the RBA announcing and then buying the bonds, it's flooding the system with cash. And that cash has several effects. That cash pushes down a whole bunch of interest rates. Because there's more cash in the system. For instance, the RBA's cash target, its target cash rate is 0.1. But the actual cash rate is closer to zero. So the actual cash rate is below the RBA's official target. And the reason for that is because of QE. QE has put so much cash into the system that cash has pushed down the actual cash rate to almost zero. So that's one effect, and that flows through into mortgage rates. The other thing is that by saying it's going to do QE and then doing it, it pushes down interest rates across the curve. So longer-term interest rates have also gone down. And that flows through into fixed mortgage rates. So if you look at fixed mortgage rates in Australia, they've fallen much further than floating mortgage rates. And in fact, fixed rates are now below floating rates, which is unusual in Australia. And that's got a lot to do with QE. So QE's had the effect of pushing interest rates down by a lot more than they would have fallen without QE. The other thing it's done is there's a competitive global game going on here. Most central banks around the world are doing QE of some form or another. If the RBA, last year when the RBA started off doing its unconventional policy, it didn't do QE. What that means is that Australian interest rates rose relative to global interest rates. That put upward pressure on our exchange rate.
Explain why you don't want our exchange rate to go up.
Well, maybe you do, actually. I mean, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that over the long run, having a strong exchange rate is a good thing rather than a bad thing. But But when you're in an economic slump and you want to boost growth, if the exchange rate goes up, it makes Australian goods more expensive. And so foreigners will buy less. Australians will buy more imports than they'll buy domestic goods. So if the exchange rate goes down, it makes your goods and services more competitive relative to other countries. So it's generally seen, at least for a short term anyway, as a good thing to push your exchange rate down. Of course, every country in the world is trying to do the same thing. So there's a limit to what can happen there. But last year, when the RBA didn't do QE and other countries were, the Aussie dollar went up.
As an objective of quantitative easing, is one of them the inflation rate? They actually want there to be a higher inflation rate?
So the objective of monetary policy, the RBA's objectives are around inflation and employment, not around interest rates. So it doesn't have a view on interest rates per se. What it's trying to do is get the inflation outcomes that's mandated in its agreement with the government. So the government's told it that it needs to have and achieve inflation on average between 2-3%, and it hasn't done that for quite a while. And so what it's and the reason for that is that's seen as the inflation rate that will best contribute to the overall economic health of Australia. You don't want inflation too high.
Yep.
For lots of reasons. And if inflation's too low, it causes another problem. So you know, 2-3 is for Australia is seen as sort of the Goldilocks level, not too hot, not too cold. And so the RBA, what the RBA is doing with all of its policy settings is trying to achieve that outcome.
Okay. So
and so what it's trying to do is ultimately get growth, wages, unemployment to levels that it thinks are consistent with achieving 2-3% inflation.
So we've got a situation implementing QE, trying to get inflation up, but what's happening is inflation seems to be a bit stubborn. So inflation is usually measured by the consumer price index, you know, whatever the cost of groceries are. But lately what we've got is a situation where the inflation rate doesn't seem to really want to be shifting, yet we've got other asset classes like people's homes. They're going through the roof. The value of housing is going through the roof. So we sort of, is there a disconnect here between the objective of inflation, which doesn't seem to be shifting, but we've still got this QE program, the $4 billion a week going on, and that seems to be affecting the housing market. So there's a sort of, things aren't going up in unison. Could you explain that for us?
Sure. So the RBA's policies always has different effects on different things. And one of the most powerful drivers of monetary policy is through the housing channel. I mean, the RBA knows, though sometimes it's a bit slow to recognise this, knows that when interest rates fall, house prices probably go up. So it's aware that that cutting the cash rate will lead to lower mortgage rates, and part of the process by which that supports the economy is through the housing market. Now, the RBA actually wants, when it cuts interest rates, house prices to go up, because that supports consumer spending and makes households positive. More people own homes than don't. So even though it has, you know, negative effects on those who don't own houses, but you know, the housing dream gets harder, more people own homes than not in Australia. So, you know, net, higher house prices boosts growth. As well with quantitative easing, one of the criticisms of quantitative easing globally has been that it creates inequality because it boosts asset prices. So that's what, I mean, again, that's what the central bank's trying to do, is it's trying to lift growth. One of the channels is to boost asset prices, but those people who own assets benefit a lot more than those people who don't. So that's one of the criticisms of QE. Of course, the alternative potentially is that if you don't do QE, you end up with much higher unemployment. And there's nothing more inequitable than unemployment. So the central banks would respond to that criticism of QE by saying, well, yeah, we know that QE, anything we do has different effects on different people. You know, if you're a pensioner with lots of savings in the bank, then low interest rates are bad for you. We know ultimately the worst thing for inequality is unemployment. So,
okay,
so we do whatever we can.
In summary, what you're saying is quantitative easing, the objective is get inflation up so most of the goods and services in the economy cost more, and therefore we compensate for that by increasing people's wages. That's the fairy tale version. But in effect, even if that's not happening and we've got certain asset classes, being people's homes, going up and we've got full employment, that's better than the alternative. So people are complaining, I can't afford to buy a house, but it's better they complain about that and still have a job. Yeah. Than not.
Yeah, that's right. And the causality, you know, what the RBA is trying to do is boost the economy, therefore put downward pressure on unemployment. That eventually to lead to higher wage growth.
Yeah.
And that higher wage growth to feed into inflation. So the RBA's objective is ultimately to push up wages, actually. That's what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
They know that the only way they'll get higher inflation sustainably is to generate higher wage growth. So that's what they're trying to do. But some of their policies have other effects, and one of them is house prices go up, and it's possible to have, if you like, too much of a good thing, and higher house prices, higher equities, you know, the higher share prices and so on have equity effects. But you're right, I think, if the RBA didn't do any of that and unemployment was a lot higher as a consequence, that would be a worse outcome.
Okay. Now, some people have said there could be an alternative to quantitative easing, that if you look at the amount of money that's being spent, $5 billion a week, why bother to create this bond creation and buyback process? Why not just give everybody a $4,000 tax credit? Or why not just put $153.85 into every single person's bank account?
I would argue that, and lots of other people would argue, that the key part about keeping inflation under control over the long run and not having hyperinflation and not having, or even elevate, you know, inflation that's, you know, like Australia and New Zealand had for a long period of time that was too high, is to keep the central bank independent. And so what we end up with is what I would call a hybrid of MMT. Yes, the central bank is funding the government. The RBA is funding the deficit by buying the bonds, but it's making the choice. It's not leaving the choice up to the politicians. And so therefore it's removing that problem that we had 20 or 30 years ago. The reason we went to independent central banks was because governments increasingly realized that they couldn't trust themselves, that they would, you know, that if you want to run fiscal policy in a way that doesn't generate higher inflation, you have to be prepared to pull back, to increase taxes at time or cut spending. But there's always an incentive to cheat, as it were, you know, for political reasons. And so therefore you want to create an independent body, really, that can target inflation. And so that's what they did with the central banks. So that's why I think the right way of doing it is the way we're doing it at the moment, which is that it's the RBA that makes the choice about whether or not to buy the government bonds. And so the government knows that the RBA might one day step back. So it can't get, you know, it's got to make sure that its fiscal settings are credible, because the RBA may not be there all the time.
Gee, it's refreshing to hear your comments about previous Australian politicians not trusting themselves with the Reserve Bank's money. I'm not sure today's politicians would be as candid. So then the major banks lend out the dollars they receive from selling their bonds to the RBA. That lending is in the form of home mortgages and commercial loans for business expansion. I know we've talked about politicians not being the most responsible if a pile of money just happens to land in their laps, but why does the Reserve Bank think they will get more bang for their newly printed buck, if I can put it that way, by having the banks lend out the freshly created money?
You know, most economic activity is driven by individuals, not by the government. And the government is responsible for about a quarter, and in some countries a bit more. But a lot of what governments do is take money from one person and give it to another, transfer payments, which I don't have a problem with. That's part of living in a society, is you want to help out those people who need help and free education, and also, you know, those are the good things. That, so governments do a lot of that, but private sector activity is the bulk of what economies do, and so you want people to make decisions about whether to borrow or not, what to do, whether this is a good business or not. You want governments to, you want individuals to make those decisions, businesses to make those decisions, because they have far better information than governments will ever do about whether or not a business is good, and so you want them to make the decisions. And so what happens is that, you know, QE, the banks want to lend money out, yes, and so they'll, and it's competitive, and so they'll be chasing customers, and then customers will respond to the incentives. As interest rates go down, you're more things that make sense to do because of lower funding costs. And so there's this whole process of generating economic activity. And I don't think you want the government doing that, because governments simply won't be able to direct what to do. There's some countries that have tried that. It doesn't end very well, really. In terms of governments trying to direct too much of the economic activity.
Because you get a hyperinflation, is that your...
Well, I just don't think governments do a very good job in those micro decisions about whether to invest in, you know, in processes or things like that, you know, all sorts of things. You know, who would government have invented the iPhone? Probably not.
For a couple of hundred years or even longer, economies have gone and down, troughs and peaks. Share markets have had booms and busts. Commodity markets gone up and down. Everybody seems to have been happy with the, let's call it, the natural rhythm of economies. Good times, bad times. Now we have quantitative easing. Is there not an appetite anymore by governments to endure the ups and downs, and it's almost like, no, we always must have things going better and better and better, and we must never have troughs or corrections or crashes or slumps? Is the thinking changing now, and quantitative easing is the result of that changing thinking?
I think the thinking changed in the 30s, 1930s. So quantitative easing is just a consequence of the horrors of the Depression and the conclusion that we needed to do better than allowing economies to have slumps where one third of people were out of work. And so when the GFC happened, Bernanke, who was the chairman of the US Fed, when he was at the US Fed, but not as chairman, in the early part of the 2000s when there was the tech wreck and so on. But his view, and he gave a speech in, I think, 2003, about quantitative easing and about basically the lessons of the Depression, and he was a scholar of the Depression. That was one of the areas of his academic research. That it was the Great Depression was largely a consequence of the Fed, that the Fed inappropriately tightened monetary policy. Now, there's lots of arguments around that, but and so they wanted to avoid that. And so when the global financial crisis hit, there was, you know, and that caused the Great Recession. There was the fear in the Fed and Bernanke that you could get a Great Depression, and so you had to do whatever you took really to prevent that. And one of the things they decided to do was quantitative easing, but it flowed from the 30s. Now, as a consequence of QE, since 2008, and one of the issues is how you get out of it. Do you end up with QE forever or QE infinity? There's been various terms raised around it. And the point you've made about do we end up being so risk averse that we don't allow the natural rhythm of, to the extent there is a natural rhythm of, maybe there isn't a natural rhythm, maybe there's, that's a misnomer. But as we pointed out, you know, in a normal cycle, there will be firms that go into business that whose business model doesn't make sense. If you stop that from happening, then ultimately that may be a bad thing. That you may end up with much lower productivity growth because you end up with lots of firms out there that are the so-called zombie firms that really shouldn't be there, but that are taking up people's time, that are employing people that would be better off doing something else. Yes, the collapse of those firms is painful, and getting resources to transfer from an inefficient use to something more efficient does involve somebody losing money and might involve people losing their jobs, and that's real pain. But if you prevent that from happening, then you end up ultimately in a worse position, lower productivity, lower growth.
David, you've done a great job demystifying quantitative easing, which means we've come to the time in the Bergonomics podcast where I ask you to explain the effects of quantitative easing on the simplest of products, the hamburger that we buy from our favourite outlet. Over to you.
Yeah, so ultimately the objective of the Reserve Bank is to get more hamburgers out. So in that simple term, phrenology, and to have more people making hamburgers, so there's more people employed doing hamburgers. And so what they're trying to do is by lowering interest rates and flushing the system with liquidity, is people going, oh, I can actually, I've got, because I'm paying less on my loan or other things, I can buy another hamburger. But the supply of hamburgers is fixed at the moment. So people's demand for hamburgers goes up. To get more hamburgers made, you want to put some upward pressure on the price of hamburgers. So the people that supply hamburgers have an incentive to make more. And because the price of hamburgers is going up a bit more, they'll demand more beef, and the farmers will respond to that by supplying more beef. And you'll get a combination of some additional buying of hamburgers and some additional supply. And that's what you're trying to do.
So the price of the hamburger rises immediately because our economic activity has gone up. More people are being employed because we're closer to full employment. And it
doesn't happen immediately. It still takes time.
It takes time. Okay. So
the lags, they often say in monetary policy that the lags are long and variable, which means they're long and we don't really know how long they are.
So we don't know how long after quantitative easing it's going to take for people to feel like they want to buy more hamburgers.
No, that's right. Could take a while. Okay. Or not, depends.
So it takes a long time, perhaps, let's say that, and then they go out and they start buying some more hamburgers, and as you've said, the number of hamburgers being made is just the same, so we get a bit of inflation on hamburgers. The price of the hamburger goes up. Does that cause the people that are buying the hamburgers, the newly employed workers, to go back to their bosses and say, look, hang on, I need some more money here because I'm buying some hamburgers because I've got a job, but all of a sudden they've gone up in price. Could you compensate me for that?
Well, that might be part of the process, but what you hope will happen is that the bosses need to make more hamburgers, so they need to employ more people and to encourage people to make hamburgers rather than something else, they have to put wages up. So wages rise because employers want more people in their shops. And so what you've seen, if you look in the US, recently, places like Walmart and so on have raised their wages because it's harder for them to find the workers that they need, even unskilled, relatively unskilled jobs. wages have been going up because unemployment's been falling. So those workers have been harder to find. So workers are harder to find, but they want more of them because demand for their products has gone up. They might have to pay them a bit more. And then by paying them a bit more, that, and this, there's a virtuous circle that you get going, hopefully, by paying people a bit more, that allows people to buy a bit more hamburgers and pay the higher, slightly higher prices. And that, again, creates more. So you're hoping that you create a virtuous circle there, and that virtuous circle becomes self-sustaining, and then eventually you don't need the queuing because you've kind of generated this activity.
So we create a bit of economic activity. People buy more hamburgers. The hamburger goes up in price. The people making the hamburgers have to put the prices up because they're trying to produce the lettuce, the cheese, the bun, the beef patty. And it's a circle because when that production comes on board, they've got to employ more people to do it. And those people will want to eat some hamburgers even though they're making them. And then it just goes around in a circle.
Well, that's the hope, yes.
That's
the concern, of course, is that you then withdraw the QE, you stop doing it, and everything slumps again. So that's always the tricky balancing act, is knowing when you've generated enough of a cycle on its own that you can start to step back. And the RBA in July announced that they would start to, in September, start to reduce the amount of bonds that they buy.
And is that...
Then, of course, we got hit by Delta. And now there's conjecture that they might change their mind on that, but we'll see. We'll find out soon.
So I've heard a term that when central banks talk about withdrawing quantitative easing, there's something that occurs called a tantrum, a temper tantrum,
a taper tantrum.
Tell me about a taper tantrum.
He started talking about the Fed would start to reduce the amount of bond purchases it did. And that was a surprise to the market. And so the taper tantrum was you saw a spike in interest rates and you saw equity markets start to sell off. And so this is the issue that people often say, is that once you've started QE, how do you get out of it? Because built into asset prices, equities and commercial property and house prices is the expectation that interest rates will stay low potentially forever or for a long period of time. And if those expectations start to change because the Fed or the central bank says, actually, we think we've done enough QE, we don't want to do any more, or we're going to do less, if that then feeds through into interest rates, it starts affecting other things. And do central banks, are they confident enough in them to put up with that kind of volatility? And, or do they get spooked? Do they see equity markets start to react negatively and think, oh my God, I can't actually change. And so that you end up with some people talking about the problem with QE. One way it's been put that I put it a while back, it's the Hotel California problem. You can check in anytime you want, but you can never leave because it just gets built into the system. And that's one of the complications. And so we don't know. No central bank has successfully exited QE completely.
From what you're saying, previously, if the Reserve Bank had created brand new money by just typing numbers on a keyboard, it would have been seen as irresponsible, unleashing the possibility of a consumer spending frenzy which kept on pushing prices up. But with interest rates so low, close to zero, quantitative easing is all the Reserve Bank had left to use to keep the economy revving along to save everybody's jobs so there'd be no unemployment. So they'd rather have you in a job complaining that you can't afford a house rather than being unemployed and complaining about not being able to afford to buy a house.
So QE will be with us for a long time. It's not... You know, maybe the RBA can get on a program where it stops buying bonds for a period, but inevitably, given how low interest rates are, when we get hit by the next big shock, and shocks come along regularly, the next big shock, it will have to do QE because it will quickly run out of room to cut interest rates. So QE of some form is now part of the normal central bank toolkit.
Right. David, thank you so much for your time and joining us on the Bergonomics podcast. You have depacked and demystified quantitative easing for all of our listeners, for which I think they will be grateful for, because they become anaesthetised towards some of these economic terms that are thrown at them daily by the media and are told that they're going to have a positive effect on their standard of living, but they don't know how or why. So you've explained to us not just QE, but also the precise process of how it's created through the bond buying process. So thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you. It's a fascinating journey, just one area, and maybe we can join up again in the future.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks, Ross. A pleasure to do it.
So, my fellow Berg economists, quantitative easing in a nutshell. The Reserve Bank of Australia believes you may lose your job because the economy is shrinking. They lower interest rates to nearly zero to try and rev up the economy. That didn't work, so every week they create $4 billion out of thin air, a lot of it which ends up as new or larger home loans. People go crazy buying houses. Prices skyrocket. More houses are built to satisfy the demand, requiring more tradies to build the houses, and hopefully more hamburgers to feed the tradies. Existing homeowners and businesses with loans have already been spending more because the lower interest payments they've been making has put more money in their pockets. No wonder everybody's buying hamburgers at this stage. Whichever way you cut it, quantitative easing is about creating more jobs and higher wages, resulting in people buying more of just about anything, causing, you guessed it, more jobs, higher wages, more spending, and so it goes around and around. But what happens when quantitative easing stops? What happens when the QE party finally comes to an end? Today's guest, ANZ Head of Economics David Plank, believes quantitative easing is the same as the 1976 hit record Hotel California sung by the Eagles. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave.